The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and South Jersey. A fantastic program is just around the corner. We have one of the senior endocrinologists in the Jersey area, Dr. Lou Hanel. Dr. Hanel also has a son who practices endocrinology, regretfully, I think, in the Virginia area, and he's an aldosterone expert. We have Lou today, and Lou has the most experience of any endocrinologist around. It's a pleasure that I can work with Lou on a daily basis at Rowan University. Lou has items to talk about, including thyroid, calcium metabolism, menopause, adrenal issues. He's got a whole set here, and everybody's going to learn a tremendous amount. Lou, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Joe. Thanks a lot for inviting me. I appreciate that.
Oh, you got some great cases here. Let me start off with number one. Since desiccated thyroid comes from animals, isn't it better choice than synthetic levothyroxine? What do you say, Lou?
Well, you're pushing me way back, Joe. When I first started, which was almost 50 years ago, desiccated thyroid was the drug of replacement for people who had thyroid disorders, generally hypothyroidism. We discovered after a period of time, of course, that substance comes from animals, comes from slaughterhouses, usually pigs and cows, and they would just desiccate the thyroid from the animal, grind it up. And it was usually presented in grain quantities, a half a grain a day, a quarter of a grain a day, et cetera. But what the problem with that medication was that it was two different types of thyroid were in it, what we call T4 and T3. T3 is the most metabolically active form of thyroid. We later learned that the T3 generally comes in the body from T4. But the desiccated thyroid had varying amounts of T4 and T3. So one day you might be taking a higher concentration of T3. The next day you might be taking a lower concentration. And we found that the problem was that sometimes when that T3 got there in too high of a concentration, it could cause problems, potentially cardiovascular related problems. So we learned over a short period of time when I was in practice that the drug of choice really is pure T4. For a patient who requires thyroid, because then the body slowly metabolizes it to T3, which is the active form of thyroid in the system. Much safer, much easier to control, and easier to monitor, because the TSH level, which comes from your, your endocrine kind of computer, if you will, in your brain, your pituitary, that pituitary has to be satisfied, and we measured that TSH level to see if it is satisfied. But when you're getting varying amounts of T3, as you would with desiccated thyroid, the testing could also be variable and misleading to the clinician. So nowadays, and actually for many, many years now, the drug of choice is pure T4 for replacement purposes rather than taking a chance with an unknown quantity in desiccated thyroid.
Got it. So again, can you explain to the audience where T3 comes from? What you're saying is the dominant mover is T4.
Right, right.
Where does T3 come from?
T3 is metabolized in the body from T4. So T4 is like what we call a pro-hormone. It runs around in the system, and it is metabolized in certain organs of the body to T3, which then becomes the active metabolite that is utilized by the body for thyroid function, if you will.
So Lou, when you give somebody a thyroid medication, what do you ask them to go to the lab, I guess, in 6 weeks? What are you usually monitoring to make sure the patient is in tip-top shape?
Yeah, the test that is the, I guess, golden standard, if you want to look at it that way, is that TSH, which I was referring to a moment ago. That comes from your pituitary gland in your head. And when your pituitary is comfortable, happy, satisfied, whatever term you want to use, that TSH level will be in what we refer to as a normal range. If for some reason the patient is not taking enough thyroid, the pituitary senses that, and it tries to stimulate the thyroid of the individual to push out more thyroid, so it raises that TSH level. So when we are monitoring a patient who is on thyroid, if the TSH is too high, it is an indication that the dose of thyroid that they're taking is not enough, and we make an increase. Conversely, if they're taking too much medication, the pituitary says, well, wait a minute, I'm seeing too much thyroid here, and it shuts down the production of TSH. So that when you see a lower level of TSH in an individual taking thyroid, it's generally an indication that they're on too much medication, and you have to back down a little bit on the therapy to a more appropriate dose.
Gotcha. So is there any special going to the lab recommendations you make for a patient to make sure that that assay is indicative of exactly what the patient has? Is there any mistake a patient could make to get a wrong lab result?
Well, there are some things that will interfere with the testing, not too many. One common drug is something called biotin that people take a lot for hair renewal purposes, and sometimes that will interfere with lab assays. Usually, the TSH and the circulating level of thyroid, which is the free T4 or T3, which we can actually measure in the blood, they're usually in concert. So that when you see an elevated TSH, in general, that T4 and or T3 will be on the lower side, and vice versa when you see a suppressed TSH.
Gotcha. I was just referring a little bit to one of the problems I have is when somebody who always takes their thyroid pill in the morning pops their pill and then goes to the lab, and we get spurious results. So I'm just curious, do any of your patients have that tendency? I got to take my thyroid pill every day in the morning, pop it, and then go to the lab for a blood draw?
Yeah, I don't particularly see that in practice. Thyroid is an extremely long-acting medication. What I mean by that, if you don't have a thyroid gland, excuse me, and you were to take a dose of thyroid, let's say on a Monday morning, a T4 dose, and you didn't take any more thyroid for a week, 8 days later, we could still measure half of that amount of thyroid in the system because it has a half-life of about 7 or 8 days. So I don't see a particular problem with a patient who goes that morning to get a blood test and does or does not take the thyroid. It's usually not a major factor in affecting the result of that test.
Fantastic. So let me just move on a second. We have these issues with thyroid nodules. So you provided me with a case. A 72-year-old patient has been requested to get an ultrasound of the thyroid, basically because probably you felt a nodule on exam. Shouldn't they be removed for fear of cancer? Some patient who shows up at 72 with 3 palpable nodules or gets an ultrasound that shows 3 nodules?
I think there's a couple of answers to that question. Generally speaking, nodules in thyroid glands are a lot more common than the general population realizes. There have been studies done out there now where they have just randomly done ultrasounds on people with no complaints whatsoever, no palpable abnormalities in the neck, et cetera. And when they ultrasound these individuals, if you're greater than 60 years of age, the statistics tell us that about 60% or so of people will have nodules in their thyroid. So to use the word abnormal when you're talking about a nodule in a 72-year-old individual may be a misnomer. That may actually be the norm rather than the abnorm because so many people develop them. Now, what to do with these nodules is another issue. It depends a little bit maybe on the health of the 72-year-old individual. If they're a very vibrant individual in great shape and you have a suspicious nodule on ultrasound, then you might consider going after it to try to prevent something like a thyroid malignancy. But as I tell my patients, and this is probably a true statement, even if we were to diagnose thyroid cancer, let's say we did a biopsy on one of the nodules and it came back as thyroid cancer, and the patient is somewhat reluctant to undergo surgery, which would be the ultimate reason to treat it would be to cure it with a surgical procedure. And they say, you know, I'm not sure if I want surgery. I'll quote up another statistic. I said, if you do nothing with this, and it turns out to be thyroid cancer, the chances of you being alive and well 10 years from now is probably greater than 95%. Because what I'm going to tell you right now sounds a little strange, but if you have to have a malignancy, then most of the forms of thyroid cancer that you would have are kind of benign malignancies. In other words, they don't usually take the life of the patient. There are very famous endocrinologists, some up at Sloan Kettering, et cetera. Even if they know that a relatively small nodule is malignant, they don't even recommend surgery to the patients. They say, well, let's just sit and watch this and see if it grows inordinately, and then maybe we'll do something about it. And that would even be in a younger patient. So there's a lot of answers to the question, depending on your philosophy and which way you want to go. Of course, a lot of people are uncomfortable with the knowledge that they might potentially have a malignancy sitting in their thyroid gland. And in spite of what I just said, they say, you know, doc, I don't care. I'm not happy with that. I want it out. So sometimes you have to abide by the wishes of the patient because it's their body and they're making decisions.
Yeah. So, Lou, I always try patients with that kind of situation. I say to them, by the way, 6% of patients who die and get autopsies have thyroid cancer, and it never bothered them one iota.
Exactly.
So that usually seems to help a little bit.
Let me interject just one thing there, Joe. As you well know, we are finding more and more thyroid cancers every day. If you look at the statistics over the last 20 years, the incidence of thyroid cancer, which is, by the way, the most common endocrine malignancy, has gone up fairly significantly. But interestingly, the incidence of thyroid death that you're alluding to right now from thyroid cancer hasn't gone up at all. So we're discovering a condition that is there and probably benign, even though we use the word malignant as a result of a biopsy.
Lou, I appreciate that. Let me go on to another question, switching gears a little bit. I've had several kidney stones, and now my calcium and blood testing is high. My doc says I have an abnormal parathyroid gland, and the levels of parathyroid hormone are high. However, I'm 80-some years old and already have 2 heart attacks. I really am afraid to undergo surgery again. Do I have an alternative to a high calcium and high parathyroid level?
Yeah, yes, you do. There is a medication that can be given that you take once a day, and it kind of mimics or imitates levels of calcium in the system and is able in many times to shut down the production of that parathyroid hormone from what is probably a parathyroid adenoma or small tumor in one of the parathyroid glands. And with success with that treatment, you could avoid surgery. The manifestations of having high calciums can be many, so you can't totally ignore it, kidney stones being one of them that we're talking about in this particular patient, but it also affects the bones, can create problems with worsening of osteoporosis and what have you. But in a patient like that, who is a very high risk for a surgical procedure, I would recommend this oral medication. I can give you the name, but it's not very important. It works in most individuals and it will get you away from a surgical procedure. If you stop the medication, the parathyroid starts overproducing again and you're in trouble. So it's something you'd probably have to stay with, but probably a better alternative for an individual like we just described than to go in surgically, even though the surgery in the hands of a capable surgeon is a relatively benign procedure. You're always prone to some kind of a problem. And if the incidence is 1% in surgery, but it happens to you, then it's 100%. So.
Gotcha. So really the only problem with that medication is it costs quite a few bucks. And if you don't have great insurance and drug coverage, that also puts a strain on someone's mind and pocketbook. Well, Lou, let me just move ahead. I'm 25 years old, I wish, and in great health. My calcium was elevated on routine testing. My doctor checked my parathyroid level, just what you were talking about, and my calcium level was very low. He is now suspicious that I may have cancer. Correct that for me.
I think you meant the parathyroid level was very low.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. And but the calcium's high. So the most common
17,
reason.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. That's okay. So the most common cause for a high calcium in an outpatient healthy individual would probably be a parathyroid tumor, a small parathyroid tumor. Now, the doctor in this particular situation checked that, and the parathyroid level was low, very low. So it's not likely that the parathyroid is the culprit here. Now, the doctor makes a statement to the patient, which is a little unnerving, because if you're the patient and somebody says, you know, we can't find the cause for this high calcium, you might have cancer. Well, there is a possibility of that, but we have a healthy young individual here with no reason to suspect malignancy. So I think you would be looking for other things. I think one thing that would come to my mind, at least in a patient like this, is a condition called sarcoidosis, which certainly could be producing the high calcium levels, but it will suppress the parathyroid. I won't go into great detail, but this particular sarcoid condition causes an overproduction of vitamin D, and that is what's being absorbed into the system at a high level and creating a high calcium. Could it be a malignancy? Yes. But as I said, statistically unlikely. Most people as an outpatient that are otherwise healthy, as I said in the beginning, with a high calcium, usually have a parathyroid problem. It's a little bit of a different story if a patient is not healthy and hospitalized and has a high calcium. There, the incidence of having the calcium being produced by the malignancy goes up a lot.
Gotcha. So the interesting thing is you noted that the patient was 17 years old and that the levels were high. So it just didn't seem to make sense, and you've got the clinical skills to make sure. Let's check for sarcoid. And if you make that diagnosis, that's a treatable condition with medication. So see Dr. Hanel, period. Can I move on to the next case?
Sure.
I'm 32 years old and stopped menstruating about 6 months ago. My pregnancy test is negative. My doctor suspects early menopause. Can he treat for this? And note, the average person goes through menopause at about 53 years of age.
Right. That patient could be easily tested if they were going through menopause. It would be unusual at that age, but one of the hormones that comes from the pituitary is a hormone called FSH, which stimulates the ovary. And when women go through menopause, that level usually goes up significantly because the pituitary is attempting to stimulate an organ, namely the ovary, which is not responding. So it's not producing the estrogen, and that is why the FSH is up. But in a patient like this, interestingly, if you look at somebody in this age bracket who all of a sudden does not get her menstrual cycles any longer, the first thought obviously is pregnancy. The second most common reason for that to happen is a small tumor in the pituitary gland that is producing a substance called prolactin. Now, prolactin is a hormone that is necessary for proper breastfeeding as you go towards the end of pregnancy. So the woman's level of prolactin will go up as she gets to the point of delivery. We're not quite sure why males have prolactin, because obviously they don't breastfeed, but they do. And the incidence of these small tumors in the pituitary producing prolactin is fairly high. And the prolactin production causes the menstrual cycles to stop. Now, not having menstrual cycles, if you're in your 30s or something like that, can be detrimental, not only making the patient feel a little bit bad because she's not cycling, but also running the potential for bone damage. Because with a lack of menstrual cycles, sooner or later, the estrogen levels of the female hormone in the body starts to go down and the bones begin to wear down. So treating this situation becomes important. A patient like this, if they had an elevated prolactin level, the next step, in my opinion, would be to do some type of an imaging study of the head. Generally, we will do either a CAT scan or more specifically an MRI to see if we can locate the tumor in the pituitary. In my experience, there's a reasonable number of patients that the tumors are so small, they don't even show on these diagnostic x-ray studies. But if you treat them, if you put them on medication, which has to be taken a couple times a week, the prolactin levels go down beautifully. And as a result of the reduction in their prolactin levels, the estrogen levels start to come back because ovulation and the whole cycle starts over again. So things come back to normal. So that's what I would, the way I would approach that particular patient. First, rule out early menopause, which is unlikely, but more likely, she is harboring a, what we call a prolactinoma, which is a small tumor of the pituitary producing that prolactin.
So Lou, how would an endocrinologist treat that situation? Do they go to surgery? Do they go to medication? How would we treat that patient?
Okay, very good question. We classify tumors in the pituitary as either micro being small or macro being large, and we have a cutoff for that. And when I first started practicing, people that had macro or very large tumors in the pituitary, even producing prolactin, the tendency was to take them to surgery, either going for what they called a frontal approach where they remove the front part of the skull, or what they do now is going through the sinuses, the sphenoid sinuses, and remove the tumor. We found as time went on that even people with large pituitary prolactin releasing tumors respond very nicely to a drug called cabergoline, which is taken twice a week, and will shrink down these tumors amazingly well, even when they're very large. I recall a patient that I had a couple of years ago who had a prolactin level in the 4,000 range. Point of reference is they're usually less than 18 is normal, and got to see a neurosurgeon right away and wanted to take the tumor out, had a large tumor, obviously. I said, before we go that step, let's try this drug that I just mentioned. And within 3 months, the drug had taken the tumor, it shrunk down to almost not perceptible on x-rays, unbelievable. And you can follow that nicely with the prolactin levels. They just drop and drop and drop and drop as a response. The average patient with this condition has a small tumor, or sometimes, as I said before, one that's hard to detect at all, even with x-ray studies. And again, the drug of choice is this drug called cabergoline. I don't want to get too technical, but there's a chemical that comes out of the structure above the pituitary, which actually suppresses prolactin. It's called dopamine. And we can mimic that medication with a drug like cabergoline, shut down the prolactin production. And then as a result, the patient is not, don't want to use the word cured, but certainly has been treated adequately to the point where menstrual cycles will reoccur. It's an easy therapy, usually handled with very low doses of the medication. And patients do very well on the medicine.
So, Lou, I just want to say that there's one etiology of high prolactin levels and loss of periods is if some of the gals want to use the tightest bras everywhere, and that if you have the tightest bra everywhere, it does stimulate, you know, the prolactin to go up. And
exactly.
So what happened? So basically, you just have to tell them not to use such a tight bra, and guess what? They're out of here.
Exactly. So, and the other caveat to that too, that you're now that you're mentioning it, is that there's a fair number of psychotropic drugs out there that patients are on, which will also artificially raise the prolactin level. So if there's any way to get them off of some of these drugs that the psychiatrists, et cetera, are utilizing, sometimes that corrects the situation as well.
Okay, so Lou, I like your statement, and I'm going to make sure no psychiatrists come on our show in the next 6 months. Okay. Let me move on to another. So I've had a type 2 diabetic, that's somebody who doesn't mandate the use of insulin, for 11 years and was taking Amaryl, a sulfa drug, and metformin, two very commonly used drugs. I'm 5'3" and weigh 256 pounds. My doctor put me on Ozempic, or GLP-1, to lose weight, and I started having a lot of low blood sugars. Lou, what would you do with this patient?
Well, what happens a lot of times, unfortunately, in a scenario that you just painted right now, the doctor has a tendency to remove the last drug that was given to the patient because the patient is not happy with low blood sugars and the doctor's not happy with it either. In reality, what should be done with this patient is to titrate back on the sulfonylurea, which is Amaryl in this particular case. This particular drug, that Amaryl that we're talking about, its job in controlling diabetes is to sensitize/stimulate the pancreas to release insulin. So if you're on this medication and then you add another very effective medication, as was done in this situation, then the sugars are getting easier to control. The amount of Amaryl is still the same. It's still stimulating the pancreas, and sometimes it overstimulates the pancreas. So if I had a patient like this and we're starting them on a drug like Ozempic or another GLP-1 agonist, I would warn them that if the numbers start to go down, start to reduce your dose of Amaryl or perhaps even stop it completely. Because not only do you run the potential for low sugar reactions, but also it's counterproductive from a weight standpoint. Because if you're even slightly overproducing insulin as a result of this drug, that aggravates the weight situation. Insulin is what we call an anabolic substance that has a tendency to pick up weight in the individual and would be counterproductive to the use of a drug like Ozempic, which one of its better side effects is a reduction in body weight. So the answer to the question really is to back off, not on the Ozempic, but to back off on the Amaryl or even stop it altogether if necessary.
So Lou, do you ever run into the patient who says, I got hypoglycemic with this GLP-1 drug and I went off the GLP-1 drug? How do you give them guidance? Because sometimes their neck is, you know, flaming up out of their arteries are flaming up on their neck and like, doctor, I went off that drug. How do you educate those patients?
Well, that can be a little bit tricky. What happens, I think, number one, most of the time when they experience hypoglycemia, it's probably not what we call true hypoglycemia. We're not looking at numbers down in the 40s or 50s, probably. More than likely, what they're experiencing is a relative hypoglycemia. Before they went on the medication, their numbers were obviously higher. The drug that you're using, if in this case, if it's like an Ozempic or something of that nature, and the numbers start to come down, the drop-off that the brain is perceiving from a number where there used to be like 150, 160, whatever, and now they're down to 90 or 80 or even 100, that's a relative change, and the brain has to acclimate to that. And they may experience it, the patient themselves may experience something that is akin to a hypoglycemic reaction. And many times it may even provoke an autonomic response with sweating and rapid heartbeats and what have you. So you need to educate them to the fact that when they're getting better control, depending on the speed with which that sugar drops, they may experience things that seem a little uncomfortable to them. If it's at all possible to get them to monitor their sugars, which if they're a diabetic, they should be doing anyway, and we can demonstrate that this is really not dangerous hypoglycemia, then usually the patient will tolerate it. If not, maybe you need to back off a little bit on the initial dose of Ozempic or whatever you're using, and let them come down more gradually so that they don't experience these phenomena.
Fantastic advice. Let me move on to another question. I had an abdominal pain, and my doctor ordered a CT of my abdomen. The CT showed a 2-centimeter nodule on my left adrenal gland. I was sent to an endocrinologist. After testing, said that this was a non-functioning nodule, and a repeat CT should be done in a year. Is all that reasonable?
Yeah, I think it's reasonable for the benefit of the people that are listening. Nodules in the adrenal gland are also somewhat common, not as common as thyroid nodules. Probably, we guess that somewhere around 10% or so of the general population has abnormalities, nodules, if you will, of their adrenals, and they don't even know it. This was picked up as an incidental finding. They were looking for whatever they were looking for with the abdominal discomfort, and they found that. Now, you do have to be careful because some of these nodules can function, meaning that they can produce different types of hormones that generally affect blood pressure. So right out of the gate, if the patient does not have hypertension, it's not as likely that these nodules are going to be functional. But what the endocrinologist did here, I'm sure, he probably did testing to rule out a condition that we call pheochromocytoma, which is relatively rare, but can occur as a result of a growth on the adrenal gland. He was probably ruling out a condition where the potassium level gets affected, and that can also affect blood pressure. And he probably ruled out Cushing's disease, which some people have heard of already, but you can get a form of Cushing's as a result of a nodule in the adrenal gland, which also frequently will produce a problem with blood pressure. So So we're assuming that the endocrinologist ruled those all out and is left with a 2 centimeter nodule of the adrenal, which is not a very large nodule. For the sake of people that are not used to dealing with this, when you get up around 5 centimeters, an adrenal nodule becomes highly suspicious, even if it's non-functioning. And many people would advise a nodule of that size to be surgically removed. But a smaller nodule, non-functioning, as appears to be the case in this situation, can safely be observed. So repeating another imaging study, CAT scan or whatever, in a year is a reasonable thing to do. Now, if in a year you see a significant growth in this, well, that may alter the picture. Then you might want to get more aggressive and think about surgically removing at least that part of the adrenal gland. They can do these now even without taking out the entire adrenal gland.
Okay, Lou, fantastic. So now we have an interesting case. I'm 44 years old, perfectly healthy, and have normal body weight. Somehow I developed diabetes, even though there is no family history. I did well for 18 months on oral therapy, that's like pills, but now my doctor says that I'm losing control and need to go on insulin. To the patient, this doesn't sound right because she knows or he knows many people have been on oral agent therapy, you know, for, quote, lots of years. So, Lou, how would you deal with this patient who you can tell must not like needles?
Yeah, correct. And most people don't, as a matter of fact. This patient, Joe, is more than likely demonstrating a condition that we call LADA. That's a latent autoimmune diabetes occurring in adults. Sometimes it's referred to as 1.5 diabetes. Most people are familiar with the fact that we generally have 2 types of diabetes, type 1, type 2. We won't worry about gestational and the other things, but they're the main types of diabetes that we deal with. So what happens to this gentleman? He presents around middle age or so with a diagnosis of diabetes, not uncommon. What is uncommon, however, is number one, he does not have a family history of diabetes. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't have type 2 diabetes, but it is a little unusual because generally you can get a history of my mother, my father, my uncle, and, you know, a prevalent history of type 2 diabetes in the particular patient that you're dealing with. So that's unusual to begin with. Number two, he's of normal body weight. Most of the time, individuals develop type 2 diabetes because of a condition that we refer to as insulin resistance. And insulin resistance usually goes hand in hand with obesity, particularly abdominal obesity. So people that develop diabetes middle age, which is very common, usually have a family history of it and are generally a little heavier than they should be. This gentleman was not. But nonetheless, he responded apparently very well for the first year and a half or so to oral agents, which would be the way that most physicians would go with a patient like this. They see them, start them on common drugs, a drug maybe like metformin, or even maybe more sophisticated drugs like we have out there now. And after a period of time, although good control was obtained in the beginning, after a period of time, the doctor is noticing harder and harder to control this individual with oral agents. What is really happening here is that this individual has developed antibodies against the cells in the pancreas, the beta cells, that produce insulin. And over a period of time, there has been a slow but steady destruction of those beta cells. And we reach a point where the oral agents are no longer capable of controlling the diabetes because there's not enough internal insulin, which is really what happens with type 1 patients, the loss of the beta cells. They need insulin usually right out of the gate in order to get them under control. So this patient probably demonstrates this condition that I just mentioned. Now, can that be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt? Usually it can be, because the physician could measure things like antibodies to insulin that can be measured in the bloodstream, or the physician could measure the internal production of insulin. There are things like we call C-peptides, things of this nature, that float around in the bloodstream that are released when insulin is released from the beta cell. And those levels can be measured. So if an individual like this, A, would happen to have antibodies to the beta cell, that would be, you know, confirmation of what we're talking about, or B, would be lacking the C-peptide that I just gave an illustration of, because that's released at the same time insulin is. That kind of puts, if you will, icing on the cake to the fact that this condition is this type, really variant of type 1 diabetes, just occurring later in life for some other reason. So it's later, or what we call 1.5 type diabetes. So this particular patient will not be controlled. In fact, could not be controlled with oral agents. It would be dangerous to try to keep him on that, because he or she could go into a condition called ketoacidosis if not properly treated.
Lou, fantastic explanation. Let me just move on to another case.
Okay.
I've had type 1, recovering the diabetes here. I've had type 1 diabetes for several years, and I take 15 units of Lantus at bedtime. Remember, the average person is making 30 to 50 units a day, and about 10 units of Humalog, a quick-acting insulin. My hemoglobin A1C is 10.5, with the normal range, say, being under 6.5 or less. So now the patient's blood sugar, fasting blood sugar, is over 200. What should that patient do?
Okay, this is a very, very common scenario. I see this a lot. The physician has the patient on what would appear to be reasonable therapy, but is not adjusting according to what needs to be done. What I would do with a patient like this, number one, the patient is on a long-acting insulin, meaning an insulin that has activity in the body for about 24 hours, give or take. They're taking it once a day. What I usually tell my patients is to carefully monitor their morning sugar, the sugar that they get when they first wake up in the morning. Now, in this particular patient, we already know these numbers are high in concert with the high A1C. I would gently increase the dose of long-acting insulin in that patient. Rule of thumb, something like maybe go up 2 units every 2 to 3 days, and I would give them a parameter to look for. Keep doing that until your morning numbers, let's say, are below 130 or around 130. Explaining to the patient they're not going to get 130 every single day. Some days it'll be 122, some days it'll be 144. But if they're in the ballpark of 130, that's where I tell them to stop the incremental increase in that long-acting insulin. In this case, it's Lantus insulin that they're using. That will start their day with a much better number and give them a much better chance of controlling the rise in the blood sugar that's now going to take place each time they eat. So I warn them then, well, this patient happens to be taking 10 units of a very short-acting insulin, which is in and out of the system in a couple of hours, but is geared to cover the carbohydrate content of the meal that they're about to take. So they take the insulin before the meal and they watch it. But bear in mind, if we're starting today with a much lower number now, then maybe the requirement for 10 units with each meal is not really what it should be. And they might have to even adjust that in a downward direction, in spite of the fact that they went up on the Lantus. If possible, it would be nice to educate a patient like this on counting carbohydrates, so that they know a little bit about the amount of carbohydrates per gram that they're going to be eating at a meal, and give them a ratio of the amount of short-acting insulin per grams of carbohydrate that they're eating. Now, that does require, you know, dietary education. They usually have to go to a dietitian, sit down, understand carbohydrate contents of foods, be able to at least make a rough calculation of the grams of carbohydrate they're about to consume, and then based on whatever that insulin ratio to grams of carbohydrate that you use on them, they'll use that amount of short-acting insulin with the meal. The other thing that I find amazingly is that a lot of patients will take short-acting insulin and then decide not to eat, and they wonder why they get low sugar reactions 2 hours later. I usually say if you're not going to eat a meal for whatever reason, probably smart not to take the short-acting insulin before it, particularly if your morning control is good.
So let me ask you, would you think about this patient having a dawn phenomena, and could you help our listeners? What is a dawn phenomena?
Okay. Everybody has a dawn phenomena. We think it's mediated by growth hormone. It occurs in the wee hours of the morning. Growth hormone is antagonistic to sugar, tends to rise the sugar up a little bit. And so your number when you first wake up in the morning in a normal individual is normal, because you have counter mechanisms to that, namely insulin production, to knock back the dawn phenomena. But there is a tendency sometimes for the morning number to go up a little bit because of that dawn phenomena. And that has to be taken into consideration. Some people have more of a dawn phenomena than others, and that can mess you up a little bit when you're playing around with that long-acting insulin. But that's what the dawn phenomena is. Everybody has it.
Correct. And the other thing is, that's one thing that I find that type 1 diabetics on insulin pumps have to become very astute about, taking care of that dawn phenomena.
Exactly.
But let me move on. You've got a, here we have a tough case. I've had several bouts of congestive heart failure. And in addition to my other meds, my cardiologist wants to put me on a drug called Jardiance. I'm not a diabetic, but I'm afraid it will cause low blood sugars. Interesting case. A lot of people are going to have this kind of case. And how does the endocrinologist bail this person out with advice?
Okay, so first of all, the cardiologist, which is not atypical, even with endocrinologists, is using this drug, what we call off-label. The Food and Drug Administration has not advocated most of these drugs to be used for other than diabetes. What you have to realize with Jardiance and drugs in that category, if that was the only drug you're taking that is a diabetic type 1 drug, quote unquote, and it would be in this particular patient, generally speaking, it's impossible to get a low sugar reaction with this medication. I would take the time to explain how this medication works diabetically to the patient. When your sugar level is a certain amount and it filters through the kidney, you would anticipate that that sugar would be expelled right out of the body, and that would be the end of it. These drugs that we're talking about, at least from a diabetic standpoint, appear to interfere with the ability of the kidney so that it doesn't allow the kidney to, how can I phrase it? It brings
recycle.
The sugar back into the system again. Normal kidney would bring the sugar back into the system. So the percentage that goes filtered through the urine is not as high as it would be. Now, when you add a drug like Jardiance to it, that prevents the kidney from reabsorbing the sugar back into the system again, goes out into the urine and lowers the blood sugar levels as a result of that. But it's not going to lower the blood sugars in a non-diabetic into any critically low range. That's not going to happen. Now, if you're a diabetic and you're taking, let's say, Amaryl, like the other patient we were talking about before, that's a problem. Because as you begin to lower blood sugars from the kidney effect of the medicine, the Amaryl is still working on the beta cell of the pancreas producing insulin. Then you can get a low sugar reaction. So I would be very comfortable utilizing this type of drug in this patient and assuring them that it is highly unlikely that they're going to get any low sugar reactions. Incidentally, for whatever it's worth, and I probably shouldn't be saying this on radio, but I use drugs like Jardiance occasionally, even in my type 1 population of patients, off-label. It's not approved by the Food and Drug Administration, but it does make it a little bit easier in many of these patients to control their diabetes. They're never going to come off insulin, but as a result of the effect of this drug on the kidney, usually you can get some better control of their diabetes. And I warn them. I never put anybody on a drug off-label without thoroughly educating them to the fact that this is not something the Food and Drug Administration adheres to, but it does work in some individuals. Would you like to try it? And if they're agreeable, fine. If not, then I don't use it.
Yeah, so I thought, was curious about this case is that the doctor was in, the patient was in congestive heart failure a few times, and the cardiologist, I think they're using a lot of Jardiance, not for diabetes, which is approved for, but they're using it for heart failure too. So right. You have a drug that can get rid of fluids, you have a drug that can protect kidneys, and you have a drug that can help out your diabetes. So I'm with you, Lou. These drugs are phenomenal in this category.
Yeah.
Let me move on.
Okay.
I have type 2 diabetes, and my A1C is 8.8. I'm also very obese. My doctor wants to start me on Ozempic to help the diabetes and my weight. I'm afraid to take it because my mother had papillary cancer of her thyroid. Should that bother the patient?
Okay, so this does come up occasionally. And these drugs are, as you know, advertised like unbelievably on television on the whole category of these drugs. But the disclaimer there is to be careful about the development of thyroid cancer. Now, when you make that statement to the lay population, to people that are really not sophisticated in what form of thyroid cancer that they may be dealing with, there's a tendency to back off a little bit. And I've had patients very similar to this say, well, I heard this drug is not good because it does produce thyroid cancer. Let's take that for openers. The cancer that is produced or has been produced by these drugs for almost 100% of the cases have been in rodents. They've occurred in the preclinical studies when they were studying this drug before they were used in the human population. The rodent population has a tremendously higher number of receptors in their thyroid for this particular substance that we're talking about than do human beings. That's number one. So there was an incidence in the rat population of the production of a type of cancer called medullary cancer of the thyroid, which is an uncommon thyroid cancer. Papillary cancer of the thyroid, which this woman is referring to that her mother had, is the most common form of thyroid cancer. The incidence of development of thyroid cancer with this drug in the human population is virtually zero. So the FDA puts that disclaimer in there because of what was shown in the rat studies, which again, probably not completely fair because of the much increased numbers of receptors that the rat has in their thyroid as opposed to human beings. So the probability that this lady is going to develop medullary cancer of the thyroid is very, very, very low. Now, if she develops a thyroid cancer at all, statistically, the most logical one would be papillary, which is what her mother had, and apparently has no relationship to the use of these, what we call GLP-1 agonists whatsoever. So I would try to put her at ease, say it's going to help your weight to get this down, going to help the diabetes in the long run, and I don't think you have much to fear from a thyroid aspect.
I think that was a fantastic explanation. I was always told that at one of these meetings that the average endocrinologist will only get about five of these type of patients with that kind of cancer. And I've already had five, so I tell the patients I've had five, so you don't have to worry about it. I do explain it a little bit more than that, but we're trying to say medullary is very rare, and so it's basically overblown, and I think that the FDA really should, because the people at Novo did show that it would take 25 years to prove that there was no cancer related to that drug because it's so infrequent. So hopefully soon they'll change that warning because it's making people upset for no good reason.
You know, it's an interesting side to that, if you will, Joe. I totally agree with you with the very infrequentness of the drug. I don't see too many of these cases either. But I know early on in my training, I was taught that if you had medullary cancer of the thyroid, it was part of what we called an MEN, which is a genetic syndrome. We now find that 60 to 70% of these medullaries are sporadic. They're not related to any of the predisposed genetic MENs like we used to think all the time.
Well, all I can say is if you have medullary cancer of the thyroid, you have to get the best surgeon because he's got to take out every single thyroid cell or otherwise it'll be your demise down the line. So great surgeons take care of medullary cancer patients, and we don't need to use them that often for that condition.
Yeah, thank God.
Let me speed up. I have cushioning. I have a cushionoid look due to treatment with high-dose steroids for my autoimmune arthritis. I'm not on steroids. I'm very fatigued. If I'm not on steroids, I'm very fatigued and non-functioning. Is this normal? Lou,
yes,
maybe you can expand a little bit more on that case.
Yeah, this can be a very tricky case. And we all see these types of patients who are intermittently on and off of what we call very, very high doses of steroids, much more than physiologic doses of steroids. Now, when you're taking steroids for whatever reason, in this case, it's an autoimmune arthritis, you feel good on the steroids. They have what we call a euphoric effect. They make you feel better, and that's a true effect. And a patient will function better just generally when they're on the medicines. what is supposed to happen after you're being treated for whatever condition it is the drug is supposed to be weaned down relatively slowly, again, depending on the amount of the steroid you were taking, the duration that you were taking it, et cetera. But it would be not very intelligent to cold turkey somebody off of a high dose of steroids, because that will produce at least a relative insufficiency of internal steroid production. You need steroids to live. Specifically, you talk in terms of prednisone and drugs of that nature, but your body internally produces those. When you're taking high doses for a condition like this, as an example, you're taking very high amounts, much more than your own adrenal produces. You do well at your normal levels, but you're on high doses, you come down, right away you feel a little bit of a drop-off, if you will, just as a reflection of the amount that you were taking. But you could also be shutting off some of your internal production from your own adrenal gland if the reduction from these high doses is too rapid. So there are all kinds of formulae for how many days you stay on one dose, then you reduce it again and a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. What can be done with a patient like this, when they're completely off of the artificial steroids, I'll use that terminology, you could try measuring internal levels of steroids. It's more difficult to do when they're taking steroids, but when they're off of it for enough days, you could measure cortisol levels. You can even stimulate, if necessary, their own adrenal gland and see if it responds to the stimulation that you're giving it, which it should. But they're many times in a relative adrenal insufficiency, if not an absolute adrenal insufficiency, and they feel it. So you have to be very careful, the physician handling these people, have to be very careful about weaning them down, because they're not going to feel good. And they'll tell you, I'm not happy any longer. And it's related to this relative or absolute deficiency of internal steroid production that is occurring, and the little bit of a letdown, I'll use that terminology, from the very high doses that they were on for whatever disease they were being treated.
So to sum it up, when you give the steroids at high doses, your adrenal gland goes to sleep and it doesn't wake up that well. And that's why you have to watch out. You need some help of an endocrinologist or your family doctor to right the ship.
Right, exactly, so Joe.
Let me give you another one. So I'm having a difficult time with fertility. My gynecologist indicates that my TSH was normal, but on the high range. And he requests that the patient start thyroid hormone therapy. The patient gets a bit upset because when you're pregnant, you don't want to add something else in, even though thyroid hormone is the number one sold drug in the U.S. What would you do with this patient, Lou? How would you calm this patient down?
Okay. More recently, it's been the philosophy of a lot of these fertility specialists, and the literature seems to support this, that if you're attempting to get pregnant and your thyroid level, that TSH that we were talking about way back in the beginning that comes from the pituitary gland, even though it may be in the normal range, and here it's in the upper end of the normal range, but it's still in the normal range. It's been shown that fertility tends to improve as you drop that TSH level, particularly if you get it below a level of around 2 or 2.5. So I'm in agreement, and many fertility doctors are also, to take a patient like that, start them on relatively low doses of thyroid and see if that TSH can be brought a little bit lower. And surprisingly, I've seen just myself in the last 6 months, I've seen two or three patients who are actually able to conceive with a TSH below 2.5. Now, I can't say that it's 100% related to that, but they were having all kinds of difficulties with contraception prior to that. So there does seem to be some argument out there, even in the literature, for lowering the TSH, not to abnormally low levels, but just to get it maybe below 2.5 and see if that helps the process of conception. And I think that's a reasonable approach.
So, Lou, I think we should stop here because basically you've now topped it off with increasing fertility for the gals of South Jersey and Philadelphia. And I want to tell you, Lou, it's been a pleasure always working with you. We still are working together at Rowan. Do you want to tell people how they can get in touch with an educated doctor like yourself, endocrinologist Suprema?
Well, the same way you would be able to get in touch with me is the same way you get in touch with Joe Fallon. You would call the Rowan Department of Internal Medicine and give them a call and say that you would like an appointment. Now, I have to tell you that I'm semi-retired and I'm doing mostly just telemedicine, but I have a fair number of patients and they keep coming back, so we must be doing something right. Joe, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to have been able to speak with you today and to help with your audience here. Thank you so much.
Lou, thank you. We will be back next week. I hope we can get somebody as good as Dr. Hanel. And don't forget to tell your son to come up to Rowan. All right, Dr. Fallon signing off. There will be a podcast within 20 minutes. www.wwbbam.com. Hit Inside Medicine. And then you're going to have 125 podcasts that you can look at your leisure. Dr. Fallon signing off. Thank you much. See you guys next week.